And welcome back to WKAR's Current State. We are live from downtown East Lansing for opening night of the 12th annual East Lansing Folk Festival, which runs through Sunday all over downtown East LA. Live performances or demonstrations happening from four performance stages or other areas. One of those stages includes a 2,400 square foot dance floor, which gives you a serious insight into think about how much fun people have at this event. This is really just kind. This is just a party, is really what it is. That's a lot of it. About almost 100 musicians or dancers are lined up and ready to perform. All of them perform at least twice, and some of them as many as four times over the weekend. We've got traditional and other food vendors, kids' hands-on activities, a folk festival marketplace. All the information is online at GreatLakesFolkFest.net. And just a sample of the music, just the music alone that you'll hear tonight. Blues, polka, Cajun, Cuban Caribbean, Hawaiian, bluegrass, Quebecois, and more. Oh, we're hearing some support for that. And it runs all weekend, and it's all free. WKAR Radio and TV are both proud to be sponsors of the event, and many of our MSU kin are also sponsors and supporters of what happens here all weekend. We hope you can join us tonight or tomorrow or on Sunday or all three. For 13 years, our first guest this evening has played a role in the Great Lakes Folk Festival. Today, Laura Helou is acting director of the MSU Museum. And to those of us in the media, she's been the go-to person regarding the event and really all things MSU Museum. We welcome Laura to WKAR's Current State to preview tonight and the weekend. How are you?
Thank you, and welcome to WKAR.
Thank you. We are happy to be here. We've taken our program on the road a few times here since the East Lansing Art Festival back in May, but this is just the perfect event for us, so we're happy to be here.
It's a great event, and we're so pleased that you're here to kick it off with us on Friday night in East Lansing.
I mentioned the big dance floor a minute ago, and as it turns out, one of the changes you've made in this year's event is more dance.
That's right.
What's new exactly?
That's right. We've got a lot of dance on the schedule this year, and people have always come to this event to kind of absorb the eclectic performances that we have in a lot of different cultural traditions, and there's just an appetite out there to not just see it, but to do it, you know, to experience it and to be part of that experience in a deeper, richer way. So we made this great connection with Paulette Brockington last year at the festival, actually. She was honored with a Michigan Heritage Award, and she said, "This is great. I want to be connected. I want to do more with you." And so we invited her to see if she could introduce a Lindy Hop swing dance element to the festival this year, and that's just what we're going to do.
Tell us about Lindy Hop.
Well, you know, I'm a novice, so I'm going to be one of those people out there on
could
the floor
Lindy
myself.
Could you Lindy Hop dance for us
that's
right,
right
now,
that's
Laura?
That's right, right. Well, while balancing all these sheets of paper and my phone and my tweets, too. So she's actually going to start out with a demonstration. She reached out to the State Swing Society, so there we're going to have some pros that do the Lindy Hop for us. So we'll see how it's really done. Then that's going to transition into a workshop, so there'll be some actual instruction of getting people all moving in the same direction and doing these dance steps. So a real high energy, a lot of movement, arms and legs, hip shaking kind of music.
I don't think there's an account of the folk festival that's appeared in the Lansing State Journal in recent years that hasn't had at least one photograph of all kinds of people dancing at this thing. So you've just is the 2,400 square foot dance floor, has that been enlarged?
We might push it to the limit. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Well, the word folk also strongly suggests history. It suggests tradition, and there's a stronger multi-generational aspect to the event this year. How so exactly?
That's exactly right. So one of the things we really try and do in our musical program is have musicians that, of course, are fantastically talented. They're rooted in their traditions, so they really are ambassadors and people who are so invested in sharing those cultural traditions, and that's always what we look for in the musicians that we bring here. And this year in particular, we have just this great group that's coming to us from the Northern Quebec region in Canada, playing Quebecois music. And that's just a real high energy, vibrant, danceable type of music. Heavy percussion, accordion, vocal harmonies. So you'll really like it. And this group is really showing us living tradition because they perform as a full band with many family members. And then they also have kind of an offshoot, the second generation or the kids that have kind of split off and formed their own combo.
Okay.
So you see kind of this respect and this living tradition, and then you've also got young people doing their thing, kind of finding their way. So honoring the past, but finding their way at the same time.
Very interesting. We're talking with Laura Halu, who is acting director of the MSU Museum, which is really the organization in charge of the Great Lakes Folk Festival here, which is getting started tonight in downtown East Lansing. You know, given the genres that many of these musicians and dancers and craftspeople are in, this has always struck me as an event for people who like to explore and who like the occasional surprise.
That's right. That's one of the real fun elements about it, and I think that's what makes this event sort of unique. There aren't that many events like this that really have such an eclectic mix or that blend of different cultures and musical styles. You know, so this is the first year, for example, we're presenting Hmong music, Hmong sung poetry, so that'll be something completely new that we've never done before. You know, and you'll find that in the landscape here, along with Celtic and Cajun and our Quebecois and blues and bluegrass, so it's just a great mix. And what we find so many times is that you know, there might be some real diehard Cajun fans or some people that really, really love Celtic music, and that's kind of what they've bookmarked in their plan to come here and see. But while they're here, they're also exploring around and sampling and finding something new that they, you know, have kind of that sense of discovery.
I think the sounds may be familiar to people who enjoy all kinds of American folk music, but you hit the nail on the head. You're apt to hear music from anywhere on the planet at the East Lansing Folk Festival.
Absolutely. You know, we've got some Polynesian ukulele. We're going to do some hula dance. So that's going to be a whole lot of fun. Very visual, very fun.
I hadn't thought about the history of the festival for some time, and I was blown away at how many years now this event has been going. It launched back in 2002, and that was after 3 years straight that East Lansing hosts the National Folk Festival. You haven't been here. Well, you have been here all of those years.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. But from your perspective, has the museum's approach to the festival changed much?
Well, that's a great question. As a matter of fact, the museum has been producing folklife festivals first on campus way back since 1987 in the Festival of Michigan Folklife, which used to happen kind of in tandem with the Michigan Festival. You probably remember those days. And it had all of the same elements. You know, it was the music and dance, it's the foodways, it's the children's activities, it's the makers, the artisans that make the handmade goods, and all of it combined together to kind of show these living traditions, the vitality of this expressive culture, how we pass it down, how we learn about one another in this country. So we've been doing that on campus. We loved doing that with the National Folk Festival when it was here for 3 years, and we've just been, you know, delighted to take that up and find such a great response in the community to keep supporting the Great Lakes Folk Festival.
I haven't had a chance to check the weather, my weather app, here all afternoon. Does the weather look like it's going to be good here?
I'm breathing a sigh of relief. If you were here at this event last year on Friday night, it was about 55 degrees and rainy. So we had some strange weather for August, but I think we're in the clear here. I think it's going to be really, really comfortable.
Laura Halu is acting director of the MSU Museum, and she is a key person here at the Great Lakes Folk Festival as we get started here on Friday night. Laura, great to see you. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The music schedule at the festival this year features several Michigan acts this year. They include the swing dance music of Paulette Brockington, who Laura referred to just a minute ago. She's from Highland Park. Also the Cuban Caribbean music of Tumbao Bravo out of Ann Arbor. And a longtime local favorite, who you're hearing plucking away in the background there, takes the stage at 7 p.m. this evening, and it's a pleasure to welcome Joel Mabus to Current State to catch up with him about his music. Hi, Joel.
How you doing?
Thanks for joining us. After many years in the Lansing area, you've moved to Portage.
So, yeah, that's down by Kalamazoo.
So welcome back to East Lansing.
Well, good to be back here.
That right over there, that's Beggars banquet.
Now, that's okay, right, one of the few places Beggars, that's still here from when I was
Beggars
here.
Banquet.
I moved away 17 years ago, and that was here when I was in an undergrad.
So something tells me
else much is still the same, but there's still Beggars Banquet.
Something tells me no matter how long you're gone, everybody's always going to remember where Beggar's Banquet is.
Now, Cave of the Candles, that's gone.
Okay, that's gone. A lot of fond memories from Cave of the Candles, though.
Yeah.
You grew up in southern Illinois.
That's right.
Your website biography points out the proximity of your first home to notables like Mark Twain and Scott Joplin. Tell us about your early days as the son of musicians and how you got drawn to folk music.
Well, I was born into it. My father was a champion fiddler. Back in the Depression, they made his living playing the fiddle with his twin brother who played the banjo and the mandolin. And my mother was a banjo player, accordion player, a piano player. And I came along. They weren't doing that professionally anymore. I was born in 1953. They were doing domestic things, getting the family together. But when I was 9 years old, the school told me, you can be in the school band if your folks buy you a trombone. My mom said, we can't afford a trombone. We have a perfectly good mandolin under the bed, though. So that's how I got started.
Well, you became a multi-instrumentalist, which is really impressive. Mandolin, but guitar, you're playing banjo here for us tonight, and fiddle. Can you explain playing more than one instrument?
Well, that all comes with learning it when you're a kid. And I played the mandolin, taught myself with a few pointers from my family. And when my brother decided he wanted to play the banjo, he showed me some chords on the guitar. So I was a guitar player all of a sudden. And when he wasn't around, I'd play his banjo. And when nobody else was around, I'd play my dad's fiddle. It's tuned like a mandolin. And I played bluegrass for years, real bluegrass. And there, everybody knows how to play at least three or four instruments. That's just part of the deal.
Does I imagine playing one instrument and having it down basically well, does that make it easier to learn the others?
Well, I think playing banjo and guitar, for example, is something like learning Spanish and Portuguese. I mean, if you learn one, the other one comes pretty good. And that's... All the fretted instruments have a certain similarity, and the fiddle has a similarity to the mandolin and the banjo, so it's all in the family.
Which one are you most adept at?
I'm mostly known as a guitar player, and I think that's the most, the instrument I can play more genres in and more styles, anything from a blues to swing to bluegrass to old time to folk music. The banjo comes with its own... With its own repertoire sort of built in. There's stylish limitations as to the rhythm and the styles you can play. Not to say you can't dedicate your life to it. And I've been playing the banjo for 50 years, so I think I know how to do it.
Now, when you work on an original song, how do you choose which instrument to use to create that?
It chooses me. I don't choose it. I've been writing songs for most of my life, and that question is usually what comes first, the words or the music. And
that was my next question.
And the answer is yes. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other. And excuse me if I seem like I'm shouting, but we do have a polka band blaring at us here.
We have, yeah.
So it feels like I have to shout. But when sometimes the thing that comes in the song first is what I'm going to write about. And then I get to choose the musical dynamic I want to put behind it, whether it's going to be a quick tune, a slow tune, a minor key, major key, languid, fast, whatever. But sometimes the musical idea comes first, and I work on the music, and the tune presents itself, and then I put the words to it afterwards. Sometimes it's an instrumental, sometimes it's an a cappella song, so who knows?
Well, you have graciously agreed to play a song here for us. Now, we've got a little bit of competition here
I'm thinking, for you.
I think we are miking you closely enough that we'll still be able to enjoy this here. So yeah. tell us about what you're going to play.
Well, I think I will do a great old fiddle and banjo tune called Barlow knife. A Barlow knife is one of the cheapest knives you can buy at a dime store, and it's the name of a great old tune. It goes like this.
Barlow knife.
Digging the banjo all my life. I ain't got nothing but a Barlow knife.
You make it look easy. Now, that sounds like a very traditional song. Around for centuries.
It's been around for at least a century and a half, and nobody knows where it actually came from. It's from the South, and it's played in a bunch of different keys, so that tells you it's been around the block a long time. There's not just one way it's supposed to go. A lot of versions of it.
How many songs like that do you know? How many traditional folk songs have you learned over the years?
Well, it would be in the hundreds, but I've never sat down to count them. I mean, at this point in my life, I've forgotten the titles of half the things. But I have to make them up sometimes.
We're talking with performer Joel Mabus, who takes the stage here at 7 o'clock tonight at the East Lansing Folk Festival in East Lansing. You're listening to WKAR's Current State. You've played with a list of great musicians over the years. They include Joan Baez, Steve Goodman, Garrison Keillor. Mm-hmm. Are there any of those collaborations you're especially proud of or are especially memorable?
Well, with Garrison Keillor, and we're on the radio here. Your folks have heard old Garrison. Played on his show 35 years ago. And then again a year and a half ago down at the Fox Theater down in Detroit. Came on and I sang a couple of my own original songs, played guitar. But it was interesting to watch the technology improve from the old days when it was a chalkboard over at the old World Theater, which is now called the Fitzgerald in Minneapolis. And now they have three semi-trucks full of tech. There's 25 people with laptop computers typing away all the time. Three or four huge Xerox machines popping out the script for everybody. So it's pretty interesting to see how things change.
Speaking of those changes, I have to ask you, how do you market your music in 2013? How do you get your music in front of people who might want to buy it?
You know, it's a good question. If I was a much younger person, I'd be hitting all the social media 24/7. And I don't now. I'm an old geezer, and people come to me at this point most of the time. But yeah, I've got a website, joelmabus.com. Have had that up for 20 years now. And a whole bunch of things you do. You just kind of swim with the flow, how can I say.
Okay. Joel Mabus, it's been fantastic to have you here with us tonight. Joel Mabus takes the stage tonight at 7 o'clock at the East Lansing Folk Festival. Best of luck to you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Among the dozens of people plying their crafts here at the Great Lakes Folk Festival this weekend are members of the Michigan Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program. For 26 years, the Michigan State University Museum has supported master artists and their apprentices who keep our state's artistic traditions alive. There are 9 master and apprentice teams at this year's festival. And Current State's Kevin Lavery met one pair in a small mid-Michigan town who are turning scrap into sculpture.
30 minutes north of Lansing, Tim Higgins' 1896 Victorian home sits a stone's throw away from the giant water tower that welcomes visitors to Elsie, Michigan, population 800. On summer evenings, the small town stillness is punctuated by the not unpleasant tinkering that emanates from the garage. By the sound of it, you'd half expect Henry Ford himself to come out to greet you. Tim Higgins is an artist. His passion? Creating sculptures from scrap metal. It's a love he traces back to his ninth grade shop class and an inspirational teacher who pushed the bounds.
Made a sword in junior high school and a Kentucky black powder pistol, which I'm sure is not quite the norm now. It was neat. It certainly got me interested.
Higgins learned the finer points of foundry sandcasting. Later, he took a job running the local hardware store. It was the perfect classroom in which to hone his metalsmithing skills. Since then, he's made just about everything out of metal, from birds to bells.
Just a meditation bell I made for a friend. She has an Aquarius massage and wellness center, and she was looking for something. They were doing some yoga classes. You know, it's an old oxygen tank and a stand that was built on it, some different rings and pieces that were found. But it can get to the point where, you know, if you hit it properly, it will resonate for maybe 10, 15 minutes.
Higgins shares his workspace and his wisdom with a protege, 22-year-old Sam Pedersen. He's at an anvil, hammering a long, thin copper rod.
It starts out circular, and then we're making it square, and we're actually going to turn it into the sun catcher right over there.
Tim and Sam represent a flickering tradition in today's high-tech world, the master and the apprentice. They met last year through the Dorman Art Gallery, just yards away from Higgins' home. Sam was in between jobs, and Tim had been looking online at apprenticeship contracts. That's when Tim came across the Michigan Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program, sponsored by the MSU Museum. It's a $2,000 grant award designed to help artisans pass down their cultural heritage to the next generation. Sam Pedersen has always loved art, especially drawing. His apprenticeship opened up a whole new world.
When I met Tim, I found out what he was doing, and I hadn't worked with metal till about a year ago. It's always been an interest. I love blacksmithing. I love, you know, just anything you can kind of mold with your hands, I feel like, is art.
Tim Higgins is not about to give up his day job to become a metallurgic Michelangelo, but he does view it as a second career. He's the only local artist he knows of who works with salvaged stainless steel. And in Clinton County, a place with nearly 25,000 cows, that's not hard to find.
What I'm blessed with in this area is a lot of dairy and a sizable creamery, which means a lot of stainless steel gets used in fabrication, and there's always, you know, a little bit left over, a little bit over-ordered, that sort of thing, I suppose. And when I can find something like that, it's golden.
Well, not quite gold. Higgins crafts with copper and builds with brass and bronze. His dining room is crammed with quirky steel peacocks and elegant Celtic crosses. He's a fan of steampunk, too, the sci-fi subgenre that embraces the Victorian machismo of cast iron. One of Higgins' favorites is a ray gun fashioned from brass tubing. Imagine Joe the Plumber meets Flash Gordon. Back in the garage, Tim Higgins shows off the single device that's at the core of his craft. It's a miniature foundry furnace made from an old propane tank. Not to worry, though. As a mechanical contractor licensed in heating and cooling, Higgins has the engineering chops to operate it safely. This foundry gets hot. Very hot.
It'll get up to a little over 3,000 degrees, which is hot enough to melt a lot of stuff.
Including this entire garage.
Oh, yeah. Caution is advised. This is one of the crucibles it goes in. It's a clay crucible that'll take that kind of heat. You put the raw metal inside it, and it just melts inside it. Then you can lift it up with special tools, you know, tongs and pouring shanks. Then you can pour it into a sand mold.
The foundry comes alive in a tiny tornado of fire. Long before the era of plastics and polycarbonates, cities large and small forged their own metal products for everyday use. Metalsmithing is an ancient ritual whose roots go back 4,000 years. This is the legacy Sam Pedersen is now inheriting from his friend and mentor, Tim Higgins.
When we worked with the metal forge, the first thing I poured was aluminum, and what was amazing to me was it was a giant block, and then it turned to liquid, and it was just one of the most amazing things I've seen. Anything that can be changed, I definitely think should be. You know, it's a form of recycling. There's so many benefits from it.
There's another benefit, too, that channels the creativities of both men. Sam's artistic background is in sketching, an admittedly solitary activity. Metalsmithing has helped Sam and Tim draw out their talents.
It showed me teamwork and how two creative minds can work better than just one. I've brought my drawing skill up to Tim. I've shown him some of the things I do. I help him draw a lot of kind of outlines for his sculptures, stuff like that. And I mean, there will be days where we just sit down and draw what we're going to build before we even get to it. That's how we work together.
Tim Higgins and Sam Patterson will have a chance to work together this weekend at the Great Lakes Folk Festival, their biggest venue to date. Tim is looking forward to the moment.
Sam and I, we have never done a booth before, you know, never done a proper show. We just work through the different councils and, you know, word of mouth, Facebook, that sort of thing. So this is going to definitely be a first. We'll see how it goes.
Today, the Great Lakes Folk Festival. Perhaps one day, the Guggenheim. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We are broadcasting live from the East Lansing Folk Festival in downtown East Lansing, right across from Harper's here in downtown East Lansing. We want to welcome a guy to our microphone now whose name is synonymous with folk music here in mid-Michigan. Bob Blackman's been associated with the Great Lakes Folk Festival for many years. He's a fixture at Elderly Instruments in Lansing, a real center of folk music in our community. And virtually everybody listening right now remembers Bob as part of the WKAR family. Bob hosted the folk tradition on WKAR for nearly 30 years. He's still family. Bob, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. It's lovely to be here with you.
What role have you played with the festival, for folks who don't know about that, and judging by the clipboards that we are both schlepping around, it looks like you're still involved.
Well, I am. This year I'm one of the MCs on stage for over at the MAC stage by the Marriott Hotel. I'm introducing most of the performers there tonight and tomorrow. And also I'll be moderating the fiddle workshop tomorrow at noon over at the City Hall stage, which will be fun. So these days I primarily am an onstage MC, but in the early days I had a little more to do with it. The festival started in 1999 when the National Folk Festival, which is a national event that moves from city to city every 3 years, chose East Lansing as the home base for 3 years. So the National Folk Festival was here in 1999, 2000, and 2001, and I was on the local committee of people who helped organize the festival and helped pick out performers and plan the event. And then in 2002, the National Folk Festival moved on to another city, and we developed our own, the Great Lakes Folk Festival. And I, in the early years, was also involved in picking out some of the musicians or helping with that. But at this point, everything is running very smoothly, and the museum has some great people to do that, and don't need my assistance as much. So I'm happy to just kind of show up and be a master of ceremonies these days.
As the insider that you are, what aspect of this gathering do you like the most?
You know, I think what I like most is simply that you can hear so many wonderful kinds of music that are often very difficult for us to hear in person in a concert setting unless we're in these particular cultures. Most of us don't get to hear Cajun music very often, or even Irish music, except perhaps occasionally at the 10-pound fiddle or at Wharton Center or something. But there's Finnish American music here, there's French Canadian, there's all kinds of great music, and all of these performers are incredible. It's wonderful to see them in concert, not just on a record. You get to see, in some cases, the clothes they wear are traditional. You get to see the instruments they're playing. In many cases, they'll talk a little bit about their musical styles. We also have some showcases where, for example, the one I'm doing tomorrow has four different fiddlers from different groups, totally different musical traditions, and we'll all sit up on stage together, and each one of them will play a tune and talk about their particular approach to fiddle and how they learned the instrument. And so the chance to hear so many different kinds of traditional music all played just brilliantly in just in one spot, and for free at that, is really extraordinary.
You've got a long list of the performers here. As you look down this long list from music all over the planet, which acts jump out at you as mm-hmm. the ones that you are really most interested in hearing, just as a folk music
sure.
guy.
Yeah, well, you know, I love, everybody always loves the Quebecois groups from the French-Canadian bands because they're just full of energy, and so we have two of them this year, and one of them is playing right now, and then the second one, Dandelion, I hope I'm saying that right, is basically Dandelion, is playing at 10 o'clock tonight on the MAC stage, and I know they're going to be great. I heard a little bit of the Finnish-American duo earlier. I heard some of their sound bites, and I thought they were really terrific. They're called Kaivama, and I thought they were really excellent.
Describe the sound if you can.
They were the Kaivama is primarily a fiddle and harmonium, which is like essentially like an organ, a keyboard duo, and the fiddle just makes a sort of swirling, very danceable sound, and even though it's just two instruments, it's a very, very rich and exciting sound, and I guess they also do some singing, which I have not heard yet, but I'm looking forward to that part of what they do also, and a lot of the music has a lot of fiddle. Most of the bands here have fiddle, which is such a great instrument, and it is interesting to kind of hear the slight variations in style, whether it's fiddle or accordion or guitar. Part of the fun is moving from stage to stage and getting to hear all these different kinds of groups, like a smorgasbord where you can just kind of sample a little bit and then move on and go hear something else. And I always recommend to people, you know, if you love bluegrass or you love blues or Celtic, whatever you're familiar with, go see that, but also make a point of walking around, hear some of the groups that you're not familiar with, some of the musical traditions you're not familiar with. It's a perfect chance. It's all outdoors. It's free. You can just walk freely from stage to stage, and you might discover something that you've never heard before that becomes one of your favorite types of music. So,
Bob, are you a player?
I don't play very much. I've played occasionally just kind of around the living room. I'll strum a guitar now and then, but mostly I'm just an enthusiast. I realized long ago that whatever talents I had were better put in the service of other people's music. I was better at talking about it and being enthusiastic about it than I was at making my own.
I think I had that breakthrough a couple of decades ago myself.
You need people like that. You need somebody to be in the audience clapping, and you need somebody to do radio and to help with concerts. But I'm just so grateful that all these musicians are here and that the MSU Museum and the City of East Lansing have gone to the effort year after year to bring them all here. It really is an amazing weekend, and I just urge anybody, even if you don't think you like this kind of music or you're not familiar with it, come down here, walk around, and I think you'll fall in love with something while you're here.
Is it your feeling that the passion that you've had for folk, is it your feeling that is reaching younger people?
I think it is, actually, although it's interesting. Each generation kind of finds its own music. You know, our parents were listening to maybe Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Later in life, some of the younger groups, bluegrass, came in, more singer-songwriters. These days, there are a lot of bands like Steppin' In It here in the Lansing area, and groups like Mumford & Sons and the Avett Brothers, who use bluegrass-style instruments, but for a little more of a rock and roll feel or a little more contemporary feel. But definitely young people, I think, are discovering banjo and fiddle, and in some cases they're going back and hearing some of the musical roots that we listened to in our day, which is where some of these younger groups, you know, got excited about this stuff. So I think the traditions, they change, but they definitely are still strong.
Listen, look for and listen for Bob Blackman, WKAR folk host emeritus, who joins us here at the East Lansing Folk Festival. He has played a key role in the festival over the years, and you'll still see him on stage here. And who knows, he might dust off his guitar and strum a few chords.
Unlikely, but if they're really desperate some year, I hope it never gets to that.
Bob, good to see you.
A pleasure, Mark.
All right,
thank you so much.
Enjoy the weekend.
You too.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Besides the music and events here at the Great Lakes Folk Festival, there's also a marketplace, but the things that are for sale there have special significance. One of the vendors is the Niaka AIDS Orphans Project, with paper bead necklaces and traditional baskets from Uganda. They were made by grandmothers in Niaka who used the income from them to support their families. Jackson Kaguri is the founder of the Niaka AIDS Orphans Project. He was a CNN hero last year, was featured in Time magazine in 2010, and is the author of the book The Price of Stones about building a school for AIDS orphans in his village in Uganda. Jackson Kaguri, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us what you did before you became the founder of this school in Uganda.
I worked as a human rights advocate in Uganda. I went to school in Uganda and came to this country to attend Columbia University in New York. But while I was here, my brother back home died of HIV/AIDS and left children who became my responsibility. And that was a turning point for me, Mark. Here were my children, my nieces and nephews who needed to go to school but could not go to school because there was no free school in Uganda.
And tell us about how the school took shape.
So we went in and asked the community what we could do with the community. And the community allowed in. They came in and provided stones and bricks and labor and provided land. We bought a piece of land, added on free land, and there we had a small school. We didn't know it was going to be big, but it was a dream come true for us to see it come around.
Tell us about the incidence of HIV/AIDS in Uganda. How big a problem is it?
HIV/AIDS in Uganda has killed nearly every person from Uganda, 36 million people, nearly each one of them has lost somebody to HIV/AIDS. It has left 2.2 million children orphaned, left behind with no mom and dad. It has affected labor, economics, security. Every fiber of the community is affected.
And tell us about your own upbringing in Uganda. I happened to see your TEDx speech on YouTube that you did up in Traverse City. It was extremely compelling. I recommend that to anybody to get a better handle on the work that you're doing. But tell us about your upbringing.
So I was born in a family of five children. My parents were poor. They didn't have any job. We grew our own food. We walked 7.5 miles to go to school. And my upbringing was very good. I loved my parents. I loved the food we ate. I loved to walk. But here was the circumstances that you saw in that TEDx. My dad would buy one pencil for all five children and would share one pencil. A fifth of a pencil is what took me to school. We all knew the only way to break the cycle of poverty and deprivation was to get that education. And we all worked hard to get education.
How many children do you serve now?
650 children in two schools. We support some in high school. And now we have broken ground to build a vocational school and high school in the area so kids can learn skills to live on by. They can learn tailoring. They can do benches and desks. They can learn to be like Mark and speak on the radio. We are providing that. WKAR, this is a great opportunity for them to know that there is an opportunity even to work in radio.
And when, remind us again, when did the schools open?
We opened our schools in 2001 with 56 students. Since then, we have increased the number every year. We have built another school. But we have also looked at the whole community as a whole, demolishing obstacles one by one that affect these children. So instead of just build a school and go and teach ABCs in a class, we provide a clean water system. We have a health care center. We provide library services. And we work with grandmothers who live with these children. That way, bridging a gap between the babies and the older generation that is still living. And the booth we have here at this folk festival is a booth full of bracelets, baskets, and beads made by grandmothers with microfinance loans we give them. Mark, we work with 7,000 grandmothers who are caring for 43,000 children in two villages.
What has it been like over the past 12 years for you to watch these two schools take shape? You must be very proud.
I am so proud of what we have accomplished. I'm so proud of those children and their grandmothers. To take CNN, the news channel from the United States, to my village and film these children and walk down the halls with the grandmothers, it was so overwhelming for me. My heroes are those children and those grandmothers.
When you first came to the United States, what was your career plan? Was it profoundly different from what's happened?
Yes, sir. I wanted to study international human rights law. I wanted to work with the United Nations and become a diplomat all my life. I didn't know what was going to take shape in the future for me.
But the tragedy that you experienced in your family changed the direction of your life.
Exactly, and you've used the words President Jimmy Carter used to write on the back of my book, turning tragedy into hope for others. The tragedy came to our family. We could have sat down and cry and talk about it, but we decided we are going to do something. And this was a way to give back, to give others, to give children a hope, to give grandmothers economic prosperity, but also employ so many other people who would never find a job anywhere else.
We are talking with Jackson Kaguri on Current State. He is the founder of the Nyaka AIDS Orphans Project. Tell us a little bit more about Uganda. Apart from its challenges with HIV/AIDS, what kind of country is it in 2013?
Uganda is a beautiful country which recovered from so many upheavals with the dictator Idi Amin. Many people ask me about Uganda, they ask me about Idi Amin. But Idi Amin was a 1970 history. Uganda is beautiful. It has the largest attraction of tourists who come in to climb the mountains, to see the mountain gorillas. It's green all year round, so you won't be able to ski in Uganda. You will ski in Michigan, but not in Uganda. It has a population of 36 million people, and it is the size of the state of Oregon. So you can see it is overpopulated, but the people are beautiful. Their hearts are beautiful. They are giving people. And when you go to Uganda, you never go somewhere else.
We have been delighted to have with us Jackson Kaguri, the founder of the Nyaka AIDS Orphans Project, a CNN hero last year. Please visit the marketplace, the market here at the East Lansing Folk Festival, a little bit to the east of us here in the main parking lot in downtown East Lansing, and you will be able to see some of the handiwork of the women of Uganda all going towards Jackson School. Jackson, pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Continued success.
Thank you, sir.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. And we've got the sounds of Johnny Koenig and his polka band here, not too far away. The main tent here in parking lot number one in downtown East Lansing. We're coming to you live from the East Lansing Folk Festival. Later on tonight at 9 o'clock on the City Hall stage, it's a performance by traditional Hmong folk singer Mai Zhong Vu. And she joins me now here from her home in Wisconsin, and she's going to talk to us about her music. Welcome to Current State, Mai Zhong.
Thank you, Mike.
For those of us who are unfamiliar, please remind us who the Hmong are and why many Hmong came to the United States.
Sure, I'd be happy to. As you know, the Hmong, as many other Southeast Asian, are a product of the Vietnam War. We came here after the fall of Saigon in 1975 when the communists took over our country and we no longer could stay there because we were allied with the United States. And so since mid-1975, we've been resettled in the United States. And you probably know Michigan has a large population of Hmong as well, but not as large as Wisconsin, Minnesota, or California.
And when did you arrive here?
I came here in 1980.
And what exactly led to your coming to the United States? How was that possible?
The refugee resettlement are made possible for refugees who need to flee their home. And the Hmong were refugees in Thailand for many years before the United States finally accepted we were able to resettle in the United States. So we came through sponsorship with churches. And as a refugee resettlement program, churches give us the opportunity to resettle, and then we, after 2 years, we're able to do permanent residence, and then after 5 years, we're able to apply for citizenship.
You are here in East Lansing to perform Hmong folk music. When did you start singing? Were you very young when you started this?
Not quite. I started singing folk song in college because of all the frustrations as a Hmong refugee at the time. I came to this country in the 80s as a teenager. And as a teenager, I have to live the Hmong life, which is very demanding as a girl. And then I also wanted to be a typical teenager. And so with all those different cultures clashing together, I also wanted to be educated. So I chose education over marriage. So I learned Hmong vocal singing, or gutsia, in college while I was going through all the frustrations. And I learned how to do it by playing pianos at the chapel every Sunday. And then when I'm frustrated, my finger just give up and my mouth just started to speak. And pretty soon I realized I was singing folk songs, because I do have a little background of it from the camp. And I learned that through college. So after college, then I started singing kutia in the Hmong community.
Now, describe for us, in your own words, describe this Hmong folk music. Does it involve instruments, or is it just voices?
The kutia that I'm going to sing is just voices. It's a form of storytelling, and we call it kutia. In Hmong, there's many forms of telling stories. It could be other poetry and so forth, at wedding and funeral and so forth. So I'm singing the kutia form, which tells sad, happy, or joyful stories. And it's just vocal singing by yourself, so there is no music to it at all.
Okay, it's a cappella. Mm-hmm. We have got we've got a track that is a recorded piece of your work. Let's listen now to Mai Zhong Vu. Mai Zhong Vu, who is amongst the featured performers here at the East Lansing Folk Festival, and we're talking with Mai Zhong Vu right now. Mm-hmm. It's you said there isn't typically instrumentation that goes with it, but is there more than one voice? Do you ever harmonize?
Not really in this form of storytelling, because you have to think about our life as farmers. We are very busy, so a lot of the singing has to do with just a cappella, where you can do it on the way to the farm, on the way back, or at New Year's. And so a lot of it is just have to do with the ability to perform it while you're at work.
Are these old songs, or are there new songs being created in this genre?
There are new ones where the young people are starting to add the instrument to it and singing along with it. But I only do the traditional one, where it's just the a cappella singing.
What's it like in an event like the East Lansing Folk Festival, in a setting like this where people are walking by? Uh-huh. There might be babies crying and dogs barking and things like that. How do you stay focused?
I stay focused because I really enjoy the singing and sharing it with the audience. And I also do a little narrative of what I would be singing, and also tell some of the stories about the song that I would be singing. So I enjoyed it a lot and stay focused by being able to be here. It's a great joy to share the folk singing with the audience. So I really enjoyed it.
You grew up, or were born, in what is now known as Laos.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And are Hmong people found throughout Indochina, or primarily in Laos?
Hmong are found throughout the world. Like the Jews, we are very scattered throughout the world. So when we talk about Hmong in the United States, we're only talking about Hmong from Laos. There are Hmong from Vietnam, from Thailand, from Burma. The majority are still in China. We are originated from what we found now as China, but scholars are still debating whether we are from Siberia or Mongolia. that piece is not settled, but the piece that we know for sure is we go as far as the Yangtze River in China. And so throughout the world, Hmong are scattered everywhere, and Hmong in the United States are product of the Vietnam War. So when we talk about Hmong in the United States, we're talking about the Hmong who moved from Laos to Thailand as refugees and then come to the United States as refugees.
Can you generalize about the Hmong experience in the United States? Has it generally worked? Have Hmong like yourself assimilated well into this country?
Sometimes it depends on who you ask. The parents think that we assimilate too fast. The older people feel that they need to slow us down. But in general, we fit in pretty good because our parents have a very strong work ethic. And they work really hard to make sure that we get good education. We also have to put in our share of the work. And with the support of the local, we're very fortunate to have a lot of good neighbors who support our coming and our processing and adaptation to the United States. So in general, we are doing well. Today, we have Hmong professionals out there who are also supporting other younger generations. So we have assimilated pretty well. I think we're losing the culture much faster than we wanted.
Has the migration of Hmong to the United States slowed down? Did it slow down after the end of the Vietnam War, or is it kept going?
It slowed down. The resettlement is only capped from Hmong who came to refugee camps up until 1978. And then after that, they are marked as displaced Hmong people. So people who left Laos after 1978, 1979 are not considered refugees. So many of those can't even come to the United States, but forced to go back to Laos or, you know, find residence somewhere else.
We have just a few seconds. I have to ask you if you've been back to Laos.
I have been about three times.
Three times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it has been fascinating to hear your story. We want to thank Hmong folk singer Mai Zhong Vu for joining us here on Current State, and she will be performing several times here throughout the weekend at the East Lansing Folk Festival, traditional Hmong folk music. Thank you, Mai Zhong.
Thank you. And I will be in my folk costume, so you'll see lots of color as well.
Very good.
Thank
we look forward to that. It's Current State here on WKAR. We're going to be played out here by the sounds of Johnny Koenig and his polka bands. The Current State weekend returns tomorrow and on Sunday, and Current State, our weekday version, returns on Monday morning. Johnny Koenig and his polka band, thanks for joining us. It's the East Lansing Folk Festival on 90.5 WKAR.